Okay, let's go over this one more time. My name is Tom Hanks. I was bitten by the acting bug, and for the last 25 years, I've been the one and only Forrest Gump.
Run, Forrest, run!
Yep, I was running.
My name is Tom Hanks. I was bitten by the acting bug, and for the last 13 years, I've been the one and only Robert Langford.
My name is Tom Hanks. I was bitten by the animated acting bug, and for the last 24 years, I've been the one and only Sheriff Woody, pal.
Come on, guys!
There's a snake in my boot!
Excuse me? My name is Jim Hanks. I too was bitten by the acting bug, and for the last 23 years, in video games, short films, and amusement park attractions, I've also been playing Sheriff Woody every time this guy was too lazy to turn up for work.
Can we get back to the point? Please?
Welcome to this episode of Tom Hanks Defense Force. On today's episode, Alex and Jack welcome their latest guest, fresh out of the Henryverse, Henry Mendoza, as we take you into the Hanksverse.
And now, for our feature presentation, Tom Hanks Defense Force, with your hosts, Alex Halpern and Jack Fryer. Podcast for people who love film, television, and Tom Hanks.
Welcome back to Tom Hanks Defense Force. As my esteemed co-worker Alex said earlier, we are talking about the Hanksverse. Just kidding, we're talking about the Spider-Verse. Into the Spider-Verse. The Spider-Man film that featured multiple Spider-Men and Spider-Gwen, of course, and other spider people.
Yeah, can't forget her.
And today we are joined by a special guest, Henry Mendoza. Hello.
Hi, nice to see you, Jack.
Nice to see you too.
Henry, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
This is your first time on Tom Hanks Defense Force, and it's an absolute pleasure to have you.
Pleasure to be here, thank you.
Yeah, I guess there were, you know, it's a film that's really...
Spider-Verse, by the way, this is a film we're talking about, not Hanks.
Not Hanksverse, yeah, it's Into the Spider-Verse. Yeah. So it's, as a film, this is... Yeah, I guess it has a lot of discussion points from lots of different fans, people who are just general film fans, people who are hardcore Spider-Man fans, and this is something that you were quite keen to discuss, Henry.
Yeah.
I think this was originally like your idea for the episode, wasn't it? So this film has been out for a while
now.
Yeah,
it came out December 18, and I remember on our end of 2018 review podcast, which we should listen to, by the way, I saw that film a week before recording, and I loved it so much, I put it into my top five films of the year. I think it came at number four, so yeah.
I'll admit, I only saw it recently. In fact, I only saw it this morning, time being relative, mainly because I was going to watch it last night, but then my parents thought it would be a great idea to watch Gone with the Wind, all 3.5 hours of it. And that's the... that was the original release version. Yeah. The actual complete version is 4 hours. So sadly that messed up my timing just slightly. But yeah, absolutely loved it. I thought it was a fantastic film. With everything ranging from its art direction, its script, its humor, its pacing, its plot structure. I was really pleasantly surprised. I know everyone generally enjoyed it, and it grossed almost $400 million at the box office, didn't it?
Yeah.
From a budget of about 90 million.
So yeah, Spider-Verse was 4 in my top films 2018, just double checked that. But yeah, it had a, just want to make sure I get the facts right, you know, like
yeah,
J. Jonah Jameson.
Just the facts with J.
Like J. Jonah Jameson, what about the facts? But no, Spider-Verse, some people consider it to be a bit of a flop, weirdly, because it had a budget of 90 million, box office of 375.5 million. So obviously it made a profit, but considering the live-action Spider films can make anything from 600 million, and Spider-Man Far From Home made a billion, the first Spider-Man film to do so, people consider it to be a bit of a flop in comparison to other Spider-Man films. Obviously, it still made 4 times its budget back, so...
For sure, and
obviously, when you factor in merchandise, home releases, streaming rights and all that, obviously, it's bringing the big money for Spider-Man, so yeah.
For sure, and I guess there were loads of questions about whether that was the result of this being seen as more of a hardcore fan theory driven film for people who aren't necessarily big Spider-Man fans or big superhero fans in general. But we'll, you know, we can discuss all that in more detail.
Also,
later.
It was distributed by Sony, and obviously there's a big thing about Marvel fans refusing to watch any. Some Marvel fans refuse to watch any Spider-Man property by Sony because they think no, he should come back to the MCU. And obviously they don't understand the purpose of business because you're not going to sell
make
your
MCU great again.
Yeah, you're not obviously going to. Because I remember during the whole thing when Fox owned the X-Men and Fantastic Four, somebody commented for the Fox should give Spider-Man back to Marvel because of the fans. I'm like, no, you're not going to give your prize billion-dollar properties to another company because the fans want it. No, you don't understand business, clearly.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I guess, sort of jumping back onto my point I made a moment ago, I guess, Henry, this being like a film that you were particularly keen to talk about, what were your initial opinions?
So it's really interesting because I remember the trailer for Spider-Verse coming out about a year ahead. So this is like, you know, must have been autumn of 2017, I think, and they had like a trailer ready. And it's interesting, like I remember hearing they were going to do an animated Spider-Man film, and I was just kind of thinking, oh, okay, this is Sony, you know, turning around and just trying to, you know, get more money out of this property. And I wasn't sure whether or not I was just going to go along purely to, you know, to the cinema purely to see an animated Spider-Man film. I'm a huge Spider-Man fan in itself, so I probably would have watched it eventually anyway.
Sure.
But the idea that I was going to, you know, go to the trouble of going to the cinema to see it, it seemed a bit far-fetched. And then I saw the trailer and thought, okay, no, this looks interesting. They're centering it around Miles Morales, who I knew about as a character, although I haven't actually read the comics as such.
Mm. Same.
But
I'm the only one here who's read a bit of Miles Morales. Sweet, I have power.
Yeah, you have more knowledge than us on that.
Either way.
But yeah, so I remember seeing the trailer for that the year before and getting reasonably excited about it and seeing, you know, there was like a hint of kind of the art style of the using of, you know, flashes of, they have that bit from the opening montage of Spider-Man, like jumping off a car and stuff like that. And, you know, it flashing into kind of comic book imagery as well as the CGI. And yeah, so I remember thinking that was interesting. And then I just remember it being, you know, really hyped up in the run-up to when it was released. And I went to see it with my little brother. And both of us were just completely blown away by it. It was, you know, it's a phenomenal film. It's, you know, for me as a Spider-Man fan, like, I grew up and was kind of reared on the 1990s TV series, which was written by John Sepa Jr. And, you know, it just feels like the film, it somehow manages to have an awful lot there for you, no matter how you come to Spider-Man, whether it be through that TV series, which incidentally did have a sort of a Spider-Verse storyline right towards the end of it, whether it be that you came to it through the Raimi trilogy in the early 2000s, which incidentally there are a lot of visual references to at the start of the film.
Such as Spider-Man doing his famous dance in Spider-Man 3.
Yeah, fantastic.
So I watched this morning, funnily enough, in preparation, and I thought, why didn't I watch this after I watched it? But no, it's got its moments.
No, I did. Well, yeah, and that's you know the capacity that the film, you know, has to poke fun at itself and to poke fun at Sony's previous iterations of Spider-Man.
Exactly, and that's the thing because it was so sorry to just
no, sure, no, go ahead.
It's so self-aware that it knows to place these particular memes in the parts that everybody is talking about in pop culture, in public forums, and also, you know, being self-aware enough to know that everyone knows the general origin story of Spider-Man.
Yeah, well, yeah, I love the fact that at the beginning they go, okay, let's go over this one last time. It's like, yeah, you know, it's the awareness, like, they've made three different iterations of Spider-Man in the last 15 years, you know.
Exactly.
That's like one different one every 5 years or whatever it is.
Yeah, and they're aware that it's not just hardcore Spider-Man fans that will see all of these iterations, and it's not even just general superhero fans. It's families, it's parents, people who wouldn't normally go to the cinema to see more sort of niche films. Mm. You know, everyone has seen Tobey Maguire's and Andrew Garfield's Spider-Man.
Tom Holland as well.
Yeah, Tom Holland's, yeah, exactly.
Like, not Tom Hanks Spider-Man.
Although he would be a great Spider-Man.
Oh, he'd be
back
fantastic.
In the day, yeah, Tom Hanks in a big era as an older Spider-Man, yeah.
Yeah, that's, I mean...
They missed the trick by not including him.
Yeah.
Many years down the line, he is perfect for Uncle Ben.
So I love like the self awareness of it. I love the art style. I love it's a really funny film. Like, you know, it, you know, it's I mean, yeah, and credit to Sony for getting Phil Lord and Christopher Miller off the Lego Movie to write a Spider-Man film, which seems like the weirdest pitch ever. Like, we're going to get the guys that wrote the Lego Movie to write a Spider-Man film. It's like,
but they did 21 and 22 Jump Street though as well, when they were involved in Solo before they left the project, and Ron Safran's took over.
Yeah, so superhero producers and Sony producers know they're funny.
Yeah,
but I mean, particularly with the Lego example, it's great because that's an almost impossible concept to turn into a film that's appealing to both Lego's target audience and adults, the parents who are watching it. And the Lego Movie has plenty of like subtle adult humor in there as well, which they did cleverly work into this as well.
Yeah. Oh, completely.
Yeah. And sorry, we should have made this point clear at the beginning. You probably established this by now, but this episode will contain plenty of spoilers. So if you really want to watch Into the Spider-Verse before listening, then we would advise pausing it now. We're on Spotify and Podomatic and iTunes, so we're not going anywhere. Henry will be back for more episodes, so you can... he's active on Twitter, so you can ask him everything then and there. But definitely watch Into the Spider-Verse if you're keen to see how the actual film plays out before hearing our discussion.
Yeah.
So just to let you know.
Yeah.
Sorry, perfect. Henry, as you were saying.
No, absolutely. So I love all the kind of the visual references to Spider-Man 2 and 3 at the beginning. Although I love that the sort of subtle changes that they do to that, kind of just sort of subtle hints that you're not actually in the same universe that we would normally see Spider-Man in and Peter Parker in, because the particular Peter Parker and Spider-Man that you see at the beginning of the film is a much more self-assured Peter Parker and a much more self-assured Spider-Man.
More all-American hero.
Yeah, he's kind of like if you, when you're like a really small kid and you just sort of look up to Spider-Man as a really cool superhero and you're not necessarily thinking about the guy behind the mask. And so he's that kind of vision. He is the Spider-Man in the eyes of the little kid.
Because, my nephew's three, and obviously he's getting the superheroes, and Spider-Man's the one he loves the most, because Spider-Man is the one you can relate to most at a young age, because he goes to school as well, he has girl problems, he struggles to find like a balance between work and play, which is a lot of things teenagers go for, which is one of the things genius of Stan Lee and Steve Ditko's creation of Spider-Man, is that he was a person facing real life problems, which is why audiences continue to relate to him.
But what I think is interesting about that is that the particular version of Spider-Man that we see at the beginning is kind of, you're mentioning, your cousin, your nephew?
My nephew,
So your nephew won't necessarily relate so much to, like, the girl trouble or anything like that as of yet. That's much more stuff that you'll probably relate to when you're a teenager, early teens, and stuff like that, and when you are in line with Spidey's age.
Yeah.
But when you are a 3-year-old, then you're just looking at Spider-Man as this really cool superhero that you look up to, and you might get the bit of the fact that he goes to school and stuff like that as well. But mainly, you're looking at the hero with the mask on, as opposed to what's behind it.
Mm. Well, it's the visuals that define that experience for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. The reason was why, like, in between every Spider-Man episode, or when there are breaks, every single advert on these kids' TV channels is always, it's loud, it's colourful, it's in your face, it's like, Hot Wheels, buy the latest edition, and it's always screaming at you. Yeah. So that's why those Spider-Man episodes are chosen by the network to be very visually focused. There's very less of a human dimension to them.
Mm. No, absolutely. I mean, incidentally, I think that the original 90s TV series is very good at having a good mix of those. The opening montage at the beginning, then you get those moments that if you're a big fan of the Raimi movies, the stuff of him stopping the train by, webbing to the side and, like, yank the train to a stop. But he's got his mask on during that, which in the film he doesn't.
Yeah.
And also you have the moment in Spider-Man 2 of when a car gets thrown through a restaurant window at him and Mary Jane. Mm-hmm. And they recreate that moment, but instead of him being in his civvy clothes as Peter Parker with his glasses on and stuff, he's in full costume as Spider-Man sitting there with a glass of champagne. You see his spider sense goes off. And instead of jumping and, basically tackling MJ to the ground to make sure that the car doesn't hit them, he turns around and he punches the car. The fact that things like that, and he puts the glass down before he punches the car as well, tiny little details like that.
Yeah. Just Aunt May taught him manners.
And of course he's got his famous album as well, Spidey-Vo.
So that was the other thing I was going to come on to, is that this version of Spider-Man is so much more at the beginning is so much more self-assured, and it's kind of like if you took the fictional version of Spider-Man, you know, in his own universe, but then gave him the reputation of what he has in the real world of, you know, this hero that everyone looks up to and everyone loves. And, you know, to the point that he kind of becomes a bit like Iron Man in that sense.
And so
there's this thing that everyone is looking up to him. The 60s TV show in this universe exists alongside Spider-Man himself. The comics exist alongside Spider-Man himself. The different films, the Christmas album, as you say. And so just having all of that. And also other little subtle things, like I think there's Coca-Cola, there's like a Coca-Cola advert that says Coca-Soda.
Alternate realities.
Just sort of little things to imply that it's not actually, you know, the usual Spider-Man universe that you'd be looking at.
Oh, sure. My favourite one of those is at the end when Miles is racing towards the Collider, there's the building called the Trust Us Bank.
Yeah.
Nice. I like that a lot.
Probably a very subtle dig at investors as well.
Yeah.
But so having all of that, and then having this big intro of Peter, this version's of Peter Parker and Spider-Man, giving you the rundown basics of who Spidey is, which is also very helpful if you've never watched a Spider-Man film, which I think this film is also very good at being able to bring people in from that point of view.
Definitely.
But to do the whole thing of, you know, after everything, I always find a way to come back. I get back up. There's only one Spider-Man. You're looking at him. And then it cuts, and it completely changes pace by suddenly playing a Post Malone and the camera panning round and seeing Miles Morales, you know, this 15-year-old, half Puerto Rican, half African-American kid who is, you know, singing along but not completely knowing the words to this song. And it's sort of, it's a complete gear change, which I love, that, you know, you think that it's going to be another Spider-Man movie of some sort, and then this is what you then realise, that it's focusing on someone else and someone different. And
exactly, who's far detached from the mainstream Spider-Man story, because he's not Peter Parker.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's not. He's not a journalist. He's a budding street artist.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's a very intelligent but rebellious and uninterested in the school that he's won a place at, which his father is more emphasized.
He struggles with obviously his responsibility, because on one hand his dad's a policeman, but his uncle encourages his graffiti art, so yeah.
Mm. Mm. And there are family divisions, even though he has a very strong family support network.
Yeah.
You know, he's not Peter Parker. He's not living with his aunt and uncle.
No.
He's living with his parents, both of whom are alive. He's got his uncle as well.
Yeah,
you know,
they are successful. Yeah. Well, they are financially stable.
Yeah.
Yeah. A policeman and a nurse or a medical worker.
Yeah, absolutely. And
His uncle likes Biggie Smalls. Yeah, well, Hypnotizer, like, sweet. I think it was Hypnotizer. But yeah, it was that fat base, like, yeah.
Something like that.
And all of this stuff, which actually marks it out, that sort of marks out, you know, from the get go from other Spider-Man films, because you don't associate hip hop music as being something that you will hear in a Spider-Man film as such, because Spider-Man, you know, Peter Parker is a white guy. Peter Parker, you know, he's a working class kid from Queens, but nonetheless, he is a white guy, and he doesn't seem to be a big hip hop fan or anything like that.
Mm.
And so to be centering on a half African American, half Puerto Rican family. And to be having this kind of soundtrack to it,
mm-hmm.
Sets out as a very different kind of film. And but also, you know, it's something that, you know, as you see when different spider people start coming into it, it's able to sort of traverse those various different genres because of that.
Mm-hmm.
To have all of that, to have the fact that his, you see sort of little bits of, you know, the kind of the prerequisites of what makes Peter Parker relatable, coming through Miles Morales in a very different way. You know, him being embarrassed because he sees some kids that he knows, and being like to their dad, "You're a police officer, can't you, like, you know, drive?
Yeah.
You know, can't you run a red light? You know, cops can do that, can't they?" It's like, yeah, but not your dad. And his dad doing the embarrassing dad thing of saying "I love you," and then
I love you.
Yeah, saying it over an intercom to the entire school on his first day.
Yeah, and he's got one shoelace undone as well.
Yeah,
is it going to be a trip hazard, Miles?
It's a great little joke about, like, little personal responsibilities that has a much bigger impact, you know, down the line in the film. But no, Henry, 100%. I guess because it's so derived from our mainstream understanding of who Spider-Man is and what the typical Spider-Man journey is, we forget a very important message about why superhero comics were created.
Mm.
Because they were for the, you know, the loser kids, people who felt ostracized, who felt isolated. I mean, the vast majority of comic creators were Eastern European immigrants.
Mm.
American culture and society was alien to them.
Mm.
They didn't feel like they had to belong, so they had to create these A, all-American heroes,
mm.
but B, heroes that everybody could empathize with and see themselves underneath the mask.
Yeah.
And I'm sure we'll come on to this conversation later, yeah, but absolutely. The way the film ends with a very clear message of this could be you under the mask.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, yeah, and, yeah, and, yeah, that point about immigrants is sort of, you know, I mean, granted, DC Comics is not sort of credited in the same way Marvel Comics is of sort of humanizing the people behind those masks in the same way. But even, you know, early DC Comics like Superman and stuff like that makes a big point of, you know, of having, you know, a liberal kind of pro, you know, pro-migrant, pro-refugee sort of message, because these are heroes that came out of World War II and stuff mm. like that. And so you had Superman, you know, fighting against Nazism and stuff like that. And, you know, but what was different and interesting about Marvel Comics was the way that Stan Lee deliberately sought to humanise the people behind the mask and to make them relatable and to have real world problems in a way that people like Superman and Batman didn't necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so to go through that and to sorry, I'm losing my train of thought slightly.
Yeah, worries.
But yeah, so to go through that and to have to sort of root it in our understanding. I remember another thing I was going to say was that, you know, I think immigrant kids in general, I think, have said with regard to, you know, there's various kind of people that have come from, like, immigrant families that have talked about Spider-Verse and said that, you know, what's interesting about Miles's journey is, you know, of him going to this new school and stuff like that, and sort of he kind of, there's that sense that even then he doesn't feel like, you know, he's a clever kid, but he doesn't feel like he belongs in this genius school. He deliberately starts to try and, like, fail himself.
Yeah.
You know, there's a really fun little moment where he takes this exam and teacher said he's got zero because, like, the only thing he's got right is his name. Like, he's even written the date as, like, the 30th of December or something ridiculous.
And there's a whole allegory if you were to give a blind person a 50-50 a personal choice question, series of questions,
they'd get some, you know, they would get
50-50 is the reasonable
they would get some right. So for you to get zero correct, you have to actually know what the correct answers are. Which shows how clever he is.
Because I think Spider-Verse is really good for representation, because obviously Miles has got the family unit, he's got two families, you know.
Mm.
He's got his own personal family, then he's got the spider family, and obviously there's someone kind of for everyone can relate to in the spider family, whether it's Spider-Ham, Noir, whoever, they can all relate to somebody. And also I want to read a quote from Jimon Hansu, who played Korath in the Marvel films.
Mm.
He said he took the role because he said this in an interview: "I have a 4-year-old son who loves superheroes, from Spider-Man to Iron Man to Batman. He's got all the costumes. One day he looks at me and says, 'Dad, I want to be light-skinned so I can be Spider-Man. Spider-Man is light-skinned.' This was a shock." And then he said later, This was sort of a shock. This is why I'm excited to be part of a Marvel Universe, so I can hopefully provide that diversity in the role of a superhero. Which is why I think it's really good to have characters like Miles who are good for representation, because as you said earlier, anyone could be put on a mask and be Spider-Man, because there's so many, and also there are so many different Spider-Men and Spider-Women now that anyone could literally, from any background, can be Spider-Man.
No, absolutely. It's, yeah, it was one of the things that Stan Lee always used to say in interviews, that you know, that his it was a complete accident of the design between him and, you know, and Steve Ditko and stuff like that. But when him and Steve Ditko were coming up with the costume design for Spider-Man, then they did a costume that was, you know, completely covered from head to toe. You don't see an inch of his skin or anything like that. It, you know, it's a mask. It's basically, as Spidey says during the film, it's a onesie. Before we had the vernacular of a onesie.
And there are multiple jokes about Spider-Man coming from different dimensions because of the way their suit is designed.
No, absolutely, yeah.
You know, and half the humour of second Peter Parker, who breaks up with Mary Jane and then becomes a bit of, becomes much more run down and demotivated.
Mm.
There are whole segments of humour dedicated to him and not being able to fit into the other half of his suit because he's just eating too much pizza and doesn't work out anymore. Yeah,
no, absolutely, and it's but this notion that, you know, that because the costume covers him from head to toe, you know, Stan Lee always used to say that they did it by accident, that was how they ended up doing the design, but that actually it was it was fantastic that they had designed it that way, because, okay, granted, Peter Parker is clearly a white guy, but in terms of just looking at the character in himself, then, you know, in full costume, it could be anyone under that mask. It could be someone who is a black or Latino kid. Mm. And that's why sort of Spider-Verse, you know, and Miles Morales as a character in particular, and Spider-Gwen, all those other iterations, you know, take that concept to its logical conclusion, mm-hmm. By being able to show, actually, yeah, there are various different people under that mask. There isn't only one Spider-Man. It can be anyone.
Even a pig.
Yeah.
Yeah. Spider-Ham, who his, played by John Mulaney.
His
perfect.
Intro was my personal favourite.
Yeah, I loved
it. Just when the second Peter Parker says, this can't get any weirder.
It can get weirder.
And it's the whole angle of him just strolling overconfidently onto the screen.
Why are his hands covered in water? I never actually got that.
Yeah. It's never explained.
there's another Spider-Verse...
Something in his own dimension.
Cartoon,
presumably.
Yeah, there's another Spider-Verse cartoon for one of the more recent ones. Obviously, in that one, Miles Morales is actually voiced by Donald Glover. But Spider-Hand's in that as well, and it's a bit different iteration. It's a bit more serious in a way. But no, I just think Spider-Ham is still just one of the all-time Spider-Greats. I think he's definitely up there. So, yeah.
Yeah. It's
there's a Donald Glover cameo in this film actually as well. You see a clip. I think it might be from Community or something like that. But there's a clip on the back of a TV screen.
So, yeah.
Of him waking up in Spider-Man pajamas.
There's actually also Donald Glover's actually funny enough in Spider-Man Homecoming. He plays the character that Mahershala Ali voices. You know, his uncle.
Yeah.
And also in Spider-Man Homecoming, he says, "Yeah, I've got a nephew." It's like, oh my god, Miles exists.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Little Easter eggs here.
The
and
connected
there,
universe,
which is great. Yeah.
It's But it's like, but they really riffed off the introductions really well.
Yeah.
So it's like when they were introducing Spider-Man Noir.
Yeah.
And
it's always windy.
Played by Nicolas Cage.
Nicolas Cage, fantastic, brilliant choice of casting.
He was influenced very much by Humphrey Bogart in the casting for that. Like not casting, but in his like inspiration for role. He was like hard noir characters.
Mm. And presumably his like a daddy role from Kick-Ass.
Mm. Oh yeah.
So where he's a vigilante. Yeah. But it's like, you know, you have this really well done comical segment where all of their origin stories are spliced into each other.
Yeah, and being played out at once. You know, kind of a Penny Parker anime version of Spider-Man.
Exactly.
You know,
like, so much to the extent that it's almost smothering.
Yeah.
And then right in the middle of that, you have Spider-Man Noir saying, sometimes I light matches and burn them down as fast as possible, just so I can feel the pain of feeling something.
Yeah.
And so, like, yeah, I think the producers are very much aware that, like, you know, we all, you know, there's only really going to be one Spider-Man story that we're going to personally empathize with. So all of these extra dimensional characters, no matter, like, sure, we might have been introduced to Spider-Man through them at some point, but there is this overlining understanding of where Spider-Man has come from and who he is that everyone will just automatically revert to.
Yeah.
So as a result, all of these other origin stories sort of can afford to become more comical and be taken less seriously.
It's just like how, like, because in Kick-Ass, obviously, Nicolas Cage took a lot of inspiration from Adam West, and here it was Humphrey Bogart, James Cagney, and Edward G. Robinson, and it is proper, like, it's obviously Spider-Man Noir universe is just permanently in the 30s.
Yeah.
And yeah, like, I love having, like, joke about there's wind and there's no draft at all.
Yeah.
But so love all of that, and I love the fact because Chris Pine plays the kind of the more self confident Spider-Man at the beginning, which incidentally, like, even though I know this is like a multi universe Spider-Man thing, it's quite a brave thing, you know, to make a Spider-Man film and to within the first 20 minutes of the film kill off Peter Parker. Granted that, you know, it's not our Peter Parker, and it's not
Peter B. Parker.
No, who is meant to kind of be our one. I guess.
Sure, but I guess it's like when Gwen Stacy was killed off in The Amazing Spider-Man. And that was controversial.
But the comic that also came in was very controversial as well when they killed her off.
Exactly.
As well.
So they know they can be more daring at this stage.
No, absolutely.
And it happens in the comic as well, because in Miles' universe, there's a Peter Parker and a Miles, and obviously Miles witnesses Peter get killed as well. So
But even given that, because most of the people that I think that went along to see Spider-Verse are not people that wouldn't necessarily, you know, have read that comic.
And actually,
I think a lot of people have said that this version of Miles that you see in Into the Spider-Verse is actually a lot more compelling, a lot more relatable than the one in the comics.
Yeah, I think the hip-hop soundtrack and the art direction give him a lot more energy.
And the Sony headphones.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Well, I'll tell you what, interesting point about the art direction, while we're on the topic, is have you guys seen the Netflix series Love, Death and
Robots? Yeah, some of it. Yeah.
I haven't, no.
You'd really enjoy it. I think you'd really find it interesting.
That's Fincher as well. David Fincher
produced it. Mm. And it's about 10 episodes of a sort of sci-fi, sometimes... sci-fi thriller, horror.
But all non-related. It's like an anthology, kind of like Black Mirror in a way.
Yeah, it's an anthology of different directors and producers from around the world have all produced little sci-fi shorts. And there's one sci-fi thriller episode called The Witness, which was directed by one of the original art directors for Into the Spider-Verse.
Really? Okay.
And you can tell that it's the exact same artistic style. Mm. It's the same sort of a hand-drawn comic effects over... hand-drawn comic effects over CGI.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Well. That's another fantastic thing about this film as well is that notion that they've not just done a CGI film. They've actually gone to the trouble of doing some hand-drawn over animation over the top, which makes a lot of the characters' faces and facial expressions a lot more defined.
Yeah, we can do that easily, mate. We'll do it after the episode. Just whack out our little cartoon.
Whack it out.
Yeah. No. All of that just makes it fascinating, compelling to watch, and they vary the frame rates, I think, at different points as well. So, like, I think they have sort of your standard 60 frames per second for bits of the film, and or 25 frames, and then there'll be moments where it's only 12 frames per second during some of the action sequences, where it slows it down, and it makes it a lot easier for them to introduce those comic frames at different points, but it just makes the action a lot more interesting to watch and compelling to watch in that sense.
That seems smoother.
Mm, no, absolutely. Yeah, the kind of the smoother action, the smoother transition between different things that were going on.
Mm.
So all of that is fascinating, and I think it's also interesting to see an older version of Spider-Man, as you say, of having Peter B. Parker, who is kind of much more meant to be from our universe's understanding of Peter Parker. He's more like that. But it's nice to see an older version of that.
Yeah, like a midlife crisis Spider-Man who's a bit tubby. He's kind of let himself go, but he still does know what's right and wrong, reluctant mental figure.
You can sort of believe that is the Tobey Maguire version, since we saw him last.
I love Jake Johnson's voice casting. It's amazing. Obviously, he's chilly in Tag. Yeah, we've never seen Tag. But yeah, he's brilliant.
But I mean, Peter B. Parker is emotionally exhausted from very real human things.
Mm.
It's his divorce from MJ.
Yeah, which is heart-wrenching, actually, if you're a Spider-Man fan, is to see the notion that... because I'm not even sure... I don't think they ever divorced in the comics, do they?
They definitely... I mean, might have done. There's so many different
versions. I think in certain iterations, then she dies.
Yeah, they just keep rebooting it so many times.
I don't think they've ever, divorced as such. I think obviously, when they were a couple, they've broken up and gotten back together again at different points.
Sure.
But to see the notion of... that's sort of what reinforces that this is a middle-aged and much older Spider-Man. I think he is actually 38.
Well, you can see the white hairs.
Yeah, it's sort of. I think the implication, I think, is that Miles' universe's Peter is 26 and has been doing it for 10 years. Our one is 38 because he's been doing it for 22.
Mm. And that's a long time, and I kind of agree with it will take its toll on you, because obviously if you're Spider-Man, or any superhero. You can't save everyone as much as you'd like to, and that does play on you, and that will obviously affect your psyche.
Yeah, and I guess the archetypical superhero ending is that they get with the girl, and then you assume there's this perfect happy ending from there on afterwards. It's almost like the universe ends there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Particularly at the end of a trilogy.
Which is usually when they end up rebooting it.
Yeah, exactly. So it's almost like we can afford to forget about the previous universe because we give the creative licensing to reinvent itself.
Because I saw this interview, I think, on BBC Breakfast years and years ago, but I still remember it. It's about how rom-coms give a false perception of happy romances because they get together at the end of the day. Then again, you never see them arguing over the mortgage for bills, who's going to babysit, who's going to do the food shop. You never see them arguing about all the things after it. You just think, oh, happily ever after. It may not be forever after. 10 years after a film, they could divorce. So
but it's a very real thing, and it's. I know it's a bit of a stereotype that a lot of people in Hollywood tend to get divorced and then remarried a few times, because it's, I guess, due to multiple reasons that, it's something for another conversation. But, we, as little kids watching that, for a lot of people, the conversation around something like divorce and a midlife crisis and the fact that, when we're growing up, a lot of... Yeah, a lot of stages of our life are much more difficult than we can imagine as a child.
Mm.
And it was ambitious throwing that into there, knowing that, you know, a significant number portion of their audience will be young Spider-Man fans.
Mm. But it's also interesting to look at from the point of view that, you know, so if you are of our kind of generation where you very much grew up on the Maguire films...
Mm. That was the first 12 I saw in the cinema... Yeah, Spider-Man one. Yeah,
yeah. It's like, you know, if you grew up on those sorts of films, then you know you are now 10, 15 years older than you were when you were watching those, and so you know that you're a bit more older and a bit more well weary. And in the same way that I think you know films like Toy Story 3 kind of reflect that, because there's that gap of time and that passage of time. Then especially because Jake Johnson's version of Spider-Man is arguably, you know, in a way a bit like the Tobey Maguire version, but further on. Then you know, you can sort of see in fact, incidentally, actually, there was apparently in the very early stages of development of the film, there was talk of getting Tobey Maguire back to do the voice.
Really?
Yeah. I think it didn't get past. I think they then said that they weren't going to do it because there were subtle enough differences between, you know, the animated version, and also it might have been confusing for audiences if you were suddenly hearing Tobey Maguire's voice. But they did contemplate having Maguire, Garfield, and Holland all making vocal cameos.
Because there's going to be a Spider-Verse sequel, obviously, with that profit and the big cult following it's got. But obviously, one of the main things fans lobbying for is a live action sequel where Garfield and Maguire pop up, or even just having all them three as vocal cameos, maybe some of the original animated Spider-Man from like the 90s or more recent ones, having them show up as well. And I think that's something we could definitely explore in the future, even in one of the comics, as Spider-Verse comics, where someone says, hey, that one looks like the guy from Seabiscuit. Yeah, that one looks like the guy from Social Network. Obviously, it's a reference to those Spider-Men existing in this, so obviously, Spider-Verse. Mm. So, because each... every film franchise does exist in the Marvel multiverse. They've each got their own little Earth name, and they do occasionally cross. They might very rarely cross over or get referenced. So that's what I would like to see in the sequel. But also, there's other Spider-Man. See in the end credits, we've got 2099. He voiced by I think he said Eric Andre, but it's Oscar Isaac. Yeah. Eric Andre is always on my mind.
Eric Andre Spider-Man would be fantastic.
Miguel O'Hara.
Miguel O'Hara, 2099, I'd like to see like some of the other Spider-Man pop up as well. Maybe like Superior Spider-Man, which is Doc Ock in Spider-Man's body. Or just maybe even Venom and like She-Venom make a pop-up. Or just like all the different Spider-Man and get all of them. 200 Spider-Men.
So I'm just imagining an Eric Andre Spider-Man. Yeah. Like he lifts up his armpit and the actual web flies out from
them. I mean, incidentally, like, I can see why in the end, you know, apart from it being confusing for the audiences, I mean, the sheer difference in how much Tobey Maguire got paid for Spider-Man 1 versus the other two. He got paid like $4 million for the first one and 17.5 for the second. He was in a position to demand a much bigger paycheck.
But it was the first big Spider-Man film reboot under new studio management. You know, it had been for a while, which is interesting because I mean, Sam Raimi beforehand was the Evil Dead guy. Yeah, he was a horror director. Yeah.
He did that Western with DiCaprio, Quick and the Dead, I think it's called. He did like a few other little things. But
He produced a Ju-On reboot, like The Grudge. He brought The Grudge with Ghost House Pictures to America. Like he was a horror guy.
Because he was going to do a Spider-Man 4, and he did Drag Me to Hell just as like a bit of a like break in between. So he did Spider-Man 1, 2, and 3 all kind of necessarily back to back. He wanted to I'm going to do
there was a bit of break.
Because number 4 was allegedly going have John Malkovich as the Vulture and Anne Hathaway as a female Vulture, which is going to then set up for a serious six film and a Carnage film. I was like, no, we never got to see this. And but no, because also interestingly,
there Michael is a fan version of Spider-Man 4 being worked on. Actually.
There is actually sweet. There's actually interesting enough that Michael Jackson apparently wanted to play Spider-Man at one point as well, and he actually tried to get the rights for it in the 80s. I think I read.
Oh god.
And also, I also. David
directed by John Landis.
I was actually going to say David Cameron, but no, it's David Fincher and James Cameron also linked to direct a Spider-Man film at some point in the 90s as well. David Fincher would do a great Spider-Man noir film.
I now just want to see a Spider-Man film directed by the former leader of the Conservative Party.
Have a referendum on which characters has in the script.
But you see, in one Spider universe that exists,
but David Cameron as Spider-Man.
One thing the film did do really well was emphasize the multitude of potential universes there are. You know, it's the whole nature of
alternate reality. Because
even
in the comic, there's a spider punk who's like a punk rocker who like he's got like a leather jacket, just a denim jacket.
So there's 100% a Trump Spider-Man man out there. Whoa. The confident to his suit.
Can we not?
I've just got this weird image of like, yeah. There's David Cameron, Spider-Man, and Spider-Ham looks at him just really nervously.
Jeez. Oh. They're all out there. This is
someone's got to do that skit.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, Lord and Miller are just. I mean, yeah. take notes, boys, if you're listening.
No, absolutely.
Yeah, we're just shoveling the creative ideas out.
Yeah, we're going to get a lot more Spider-Verse. There's going to be the TV series, which is meant a Spider-Verse series coming out. Obviously, we're going to have further comics. We're also going to have a Spider-Women film, which is going to feature Spider-Woman and Silk as well as Gwen Stacy. So. Mm-hmm. You know, you might even see the Mary Jane Spider-Woman, which has actually in the comics as well, pop up as well. And there's hundreds of other Spider-Men as well, not just Peter Parker. There's like Scarlet Spider as well. I think there's one called Kane. Obviously, Tom Hardy's Venom could pop up in a vocal cameo as well.
I want to see how a modern director would adapt the Rhino to the screen.
Yeah, yeah. Paul Giamatti.
Because he's just a massive, muscly guy who's like the Juggernaut in a Rhino costume.
Yeah, well, I mean, they tried doing that for Amazing Spider-Man 2.
Paul Giamatti. Really
well. Yeah. I'm the Rhino! Sure, but I guess... I guess with the technology standards that we now have in comparison to the last few years.
Yeah.
Because there has been that leap.
No, absolutely.
But it's... And our standards have changed, probably more importantly... But yeah, it'd be interesting, and I guess obviously what's his name, Ian Griffith, what's his name, he was the Lizard.
Oh, Dr. Kurt Connors.
The
actor. Oh, Reese Evans.
That's it. Yeah. I'd be interested again to see how they do the Lizard again.
Yeah. Incidentally, there's a nice little moment in Spider Gwen's origin story in this film where she talks about her version's Peter Parker dying and how she couldn't save him. There is a very subtle kind of visual reference, which is a reference to her comic, which is that in her universe, Peter Parker becomes the Lizard and he dies. He dies in a battle with her. In her universe then she gets bitten by the spider and Peter Parker becomes the Lizard and then ends up dying, and that's that's another thing actually that I love about this film is the way that it explores there's a gag even from Spider-Man Noir saying this is a hardcore origin story Miles.
when he finds out
that his uncle the Prowler is his uncle is the Prowler. And to be able to do those origin stories where they talk about the different people that they lost, whether it was Uncle Ben, who incidentally there is a nice little vocal cameo from I think it's Cliff Robertson who played Uncle Ben in the original Raimi films, and people talk about how J.K. Simmons is like the definitive version of J. Jonah Jameson, but I think Cliff Robertson is probably one of the definitive versions of Uncle Ben in a lot of
until we get Tom Hanks as Uncle Ben.
Tom Hanks comes along,
there's one actor who could play both Uncle Ben and Abramson, and that's John Voight.
Oh my god.
Did you see that?
There was a rumour that in the remake it was going to be either Hugh Laurie or Ice Cube as J. Jonah Jameson. And I can actually see Ice Cube as like a really hard one, J. Jonah Jameson. Because obviously he was the principal, one of the chief, in the Jump Street films. So just get that as a newspaper editor.
But he's a scary character. He's domineering. Jameson. Not just Hugh Laurie.
I mean, Ice Cube.
I'm sure he can act scary, but...
Get Ice T as J. Jonah Jameson.
Yeah, but Jameson is... he's meant to be intimidating. Mm. He's meant to be this... he's meant to be a boss that came around... almost like they came out of the 1920s.
Yeah.
This boss that they were the all-powerful godlike authority. They were untouchable.
Yeah. So now I want to see Spider-Man Noir's J. Jonah Jameson.
Yeah. Which would probably be like a mafia boss.
Yeah, has a continuously flying Tommy gun in his
like
office.
Joe Pesci or something.
De Niro.
Yeah.
Joe Pesci now. Funny how? Where's my photos? How is this funny? Really ridiculous.
But this is the thing, and I guess to add a more serious angle to this. This is, I think, the way we're discussing which actors could play each character.
Yeah.
And we're all designing our own personal Spider-Man dream films, which is very subjectively, very casually. But I think that's really what Into the Spider-Verse is about.
Yeah.
It's about everyone's, and you touched on this earlier, Henry, everyone's different imagination about what Spider-Man should be, how they came to become Spider-Man, what the overall Peter Parker story is, like what their ideal villains are. Like, and that's, you know, that's really a testimony to the depth and complexity of the Marvel Connected Universe.
Yeah,
it's a very personal, emotional relationship.
Because when I went to university, obviously there was different societies. There was a comic book society and a science fiction fantasy society, and somebody actually left one of the societies because there was some who didn't like Spider-Man. He said he couldn't be part of society, of that society who didn't like Spider-Man, because people are so damn protective of this character.
Mm.
But obviously, when you have so many iterations of it, it means you can be protective of different versions, you know. You can have different versions can relate to you. Like, say, as obviously us in our mid-20s, you know, we can relate potentially to people start seeing a bit of ourselves in Peter B. Parker. Like, oh, that could be us in 10 years. Middle-aged audience can see a bit of him as well.
Yeah, I think it's important that Into the Spider-Verse threw a lot of humour in there.
It was really funny.
To ensure it wasn't pretentious. Because, I mean, you know, look, controversial point. You know, there are issues that a lot of people would argue within cultures like Comic-Con and within superhero fandom where certain people get very overprotective about the fact that, you know, their ideal Spider-Man is like the one and only Spider-Man.
Peter Parker must always be a white guy, or Spider-Man must always be a white guy, a male, straight, all that kind of thing.
Yeah,
you know, Tom Holland apparently got shit before because he said that he's open to the idea of Spider-Man being gay.
Yeah, you know? And there's so much like aggressive, like, there's not even like a civil conversation around, you know, just the possible different interpretations of,
you know,
of Spider-Man.
This isn't even necessarily new, though. Not saying despite in the 80s, though, when Michael Keaton got cast as Batman, people actually wrote letters into Warner Brothers to say he shouldn't be cast, you know. Obviously, they actually had to physically write something down, pay for a stamp, and post it, you know. That obviously, people, comic book fans, you know, there's a lot of great passion in this scene. There's also a lot of horrible vitriol in it, you know.
Yeah.
Obviously, you have Brie Larson's Captain Marvel comment, you know, people went on the
that was awful. People went on the whole saga around
People actually went on a campaign to like deliberately disliking her YouTube videos to try and like ruin the promotion of Captain Marvel. And you're thinking, you're sitting there, you're spending your evening going through Brie Larson's videos on YouTube, making videos about it and disliking videos just to try and like ruin, get the promotional and the algorithm. You're thinking, what life is that?
And like this stuff is, it's just embarrassing.
Yeah.
It's really embarrassing. And I think Into the Spider-Verse did ease that by making it humorous.
Yeah, but incidentally, there's a great little gag in relation to all of that when, you know, Peter B. Parker is planning, you know, him and Miles' kind of assault on the on Doc Ock's lab to try and get, you know, the data that they need for the goober and that kind of thing. And he's like planning out, and he's going, step one, I do this. Step two, I do this. Step three, I find the head of the lab. And Miles says, actually, she's the head of the lab. And he goes, step four, I reevaluate my personal biases.
Yeah, exactly.
I thought it was good having a female Doc Ock as well, because it completely just, no one expected it coming.
Mm.
Just because everyone's got this image of Doc Ock being Alfred Molina or just like a Toby Jones-esque guy.
Mm.
But when it turned out to be a female Doc Ock, nobody saw that coming. And obviously that made the big reveal much more shocking and entertaining.
Which is good as well, because you know, Doc Ock does sort of actually appear very, very briefly in that opening montage as the one that throws the car, but you only see the tentacles.
Yeah.
You don't see Doc Ock themselves. And so they
who attacks Spider-Gwen?
No, in the opening montage when Chris Pine Spider-Man punches the car, see just, just fleetingly, you see Doc Ock's tentacles in the distance.
But that's similar in a Spider-Gwen's story of how she arrives in Miles' universe, because just before the portal sucks her in, you see one of the tentacles slam into the the steel that she's climbing up.
Mm.
So yeah, but again, it's only the end of the tentacle. So
One of the other things as well is that, you know, in terms of, because there are a lot of villains in this film. I think there's probably got the most villains in any one Spider-Man film that we've had yet.
Sure.
And there's I think a lot of talk about how in previous iterations of live-action Spider-Man, whether it be Spider-Man 3 or Amazing Spider-Man 2, or if we're just talking in general about sort of, you know, say in the, with the DC cinematic universe, how they've tried to like cram in heroes too quickly with the Justice League and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, there's this idea that if you try and introduce too many villains or heroes in one go, then it doesn't work because you can't possibly serve them all well enough, and the whole thing just ends up feeling too crowded. And what I think possibly, maybe this is the nature of the art form of it being an animated film, whereas if it was, you know, a live-action thing with big-name actors, you'd feel obligated to make sure they all got the right amount of screen time. But I think by it being an animated film, then they're actually a bit more able to afford to go, okay, yeah, we've got like these six or seven different versions of Spider-Man and these six or seven different villains, but we're just going to focus in on two or three. Mm. You know, you have, you know, so it's mainly a film about Miles first and foremost, then Peter B, and then Gwen. You know, those are the three kind of that it centres around. All the others are sort of, you know, come in later. And likewise, villain-wise, it's mainly about the Kingpin, Doc Ock, and the Prowler.
Yeah, you have like people, yeah, Scorpion pop up as well.
Yeah, you have scene. Scorpion and Tombstone popping up in the fights and stuff like that. But you know, you don't have to introduce all of the villains and give them their big backstory. And like you said earlier, with the other Spider-Men, like you can have quite a fleeting comedic backstory for them that you can show all at the same time.
Yeah,
and I think that that sort of shows that with the art form, and perhaps it's the sort of thing that actually like the live action films could be more daring at doing, is that like don't feel pressured, like. You know, you could have big name actors playing like these mini parts who might be quite happy to just do it as a cameo and turn up and do it on one day. But you know, you don't have to feel pressure to try and make sure that, you know, all of the villains and all the particular heroes are equally well served. Because I think that is what ends up, you know, making it feel like these things are overcrowded and crammed.
Exactly.
I think it does that, having more actors on the screen. Like, obviously, I get what your point is, because obviously so many films, superhero films, suffer from villain fatigue in a way, there's too many at once. But obviously with animation, I think the style makes it a bit better in a way, if you know what I mean?
Sure, because by the nature of a comic book, you can cram so many more unrealistic things in, because it's by default not bound to the same sort of format of a universe that we would expect to see in a film. But also, you know, it's, you're not just limited by a budget or special effects or resources on set,
because animation can do so much more of that.
Exactly, and you're working with very different methods of framing, very different methods of controlling what appears on the screen. And it's, yeah, exactly, it's, you know, you're not limited by, you know, by the same things that you are in a live action non-animated yeah, but still a very CGI-focused film.
Yeah, and it's not even limited by, you know, the fourth wall in many cases as well, because like there's that moment where they're crawling through the air vent, which is a classic Spider-Man thing, that Spider-Man is always getting into places by crawling through an air vent.
Yeah.
But when Peter and Miles are both crawling through the air vent to try and get into the building, and they eavesdrop on Doc Ock and Kingpin's conversation.
Oh, this is fantastic.
And,
yeah.
And I just love the moment when, you know, but Peter is like kind of explaining it to Miles and goes, yeah, they're having their typical villain conversation. This is all fairly Spider-Man stuff, typical Spider-Man stuff you get used to. And then he goes, next thing Kingpin's going to say is, you have 24 hours.
And then Kingpin, you have 24 hours.
Which also I love, because it feels like, and I'm not sure if it's deliberate or not, but there was a moment in the 90s Spider-Man series where Kingpin has like corralled the Sinister Six together, and they've like tied Spider-Man up and all that kind of thing, and Kingpin's telling him his sinister plan of world domination, and then but Spider-Man actually turns around and says, Kingpin, world domination? Now you sound like a Saturday morning cartoon villain. And he practically does like a knowing wink at the camera, you know. It's like
yeah, I like, my favorite bit is when Miles's roommate is like, that is in the room that all six from all like on the ceiling scuffling about. Yeah. And Spider-Ham says, I don't want...
Do animals talk in this universe? Because I don't want to freak him out.
Yeah, I just love Spider-Ham. He's obviously the overtly comic one, but when he defeats... I think it's Scorpion at the end with his hammer.
With his hammer.
Yeah, that's just so good.
You got a problem with cartoons?
Yeah.
And it's just when he arrives in the school after being bitten by the spider. And then, in comic fashion, all of his thoughts start appearing as actual like speech boxes,
and which doesn't happen before. And why can I see all my thoughts?
It's that meta-ness, self-awareness of
when he then runs into the teacher and goes, Morales, you were out late last night. Play dumb. Who's Morales? Not that dumb. and the fact that he keeps wondering if he's hit puberty as well, which is a nice little gag, because a lot of people think that Spider-Man in itself is, you know, and him getting bitten by the spider is a metaphor for puberty. So to have that as a gag in there is quite nice, even though this particular version of Spider-Man, it's not so much, you know, a lot of the metaphors are not puberty related, they're more related to, you know, actually what it's like to be an immigrant, as you said earlier.
Mm.
And just one more thing before we wind up, because I don't think we have mentioned it, but can we just talk about Stan Lee's cameos in the film?
Oh, fantastic.
And, yeah, and his appearance.
The moment everyone's waiting for.
Yeah, so the Stan Lee cameo in the film of him selling a child Spider-Man costume to Miles Morales. And says no refunds. It always fits eventually. But so there's that. There's also one where I think just after Miles has saved Peter B. When they're being chased by police. But then I think they do fall down into the middle of the pavement, and both Post Malone and Stan Lee walk straight past them. And Stan Lee steps over them. But because I think Stan Lee had died by the point that Spider-Verse made it to the screen. Mm-hmm. And so to have that little moment of him, there's a sinister sort of businessman look of his face on there, but actually, the notion of him saying it always fits eventually is quite, it's a nice little poignant moment.
Yeah,
there.
The key message of what that really means is clear enough.
Yeah, it's, absolutely. Yeah. And for them to also have, like, just right at the end of the credits, to have an image of, his iconic sunglasses. And do we have the quote to hand, actually?
Which
to read?
One? Oh, the glasses one, yeah, glasses certainly. Quote. Let me just...
The big quote itself.
The big quote itself was with the glasses mid-credits. So they gave a tribute to Ditko as well as Stanley, which I thought was really good. But the quote is, "That person who helped others simply because it should or must be done, and because it is the right thing to do, is indeed, without a doubt, a real superhero."
And Stan Lee, is an absolute example of that.
Exactly.
And all credit to him, for creating this character that, that still, well over 50 years later, we're still talking about and that we're still, loving and adoring.
Yeah, and are still inspired to see Spider-Man in our own personal lights.
Mm.
We imagine our own variations of Spider-Man, which we've talked about multiple times during this episode. And I guess the whole nature of a superhero being about an ordinary and minority individual who is given powers to achieve the things that would have been impossible to do otherwise, to save whole cities that would have been impossible otherwise, is a real metaphor for action speaking louder than words.
Yeah. But also, this notion that, it does highlight a lot in the film because there's it's so well balanced between the humour but also the real heart of the film and the heart of the characters. There is talk about how you can't save everyone and that a lot of it is a leap of faith. But nevertheless, you can try, and that is, that is what makes people Spider-Man. What makes you different is what makes you Spider-Man. And the notion that no matter how many hits you take, you always find a way to get back up.
Exactly. Jack, any last points?
No, but bring on the sequel.
Absolutely. Into the Spider-Verses.
Yeah. Into the Spider-Verse 2, verse hard, I don't know.
Verse hard.
Love it. Henry, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me on, and thank you for allowing me to geek out over Spider-Man.
Absolutely. Like, we'd love to have you on again. I think it's fair to say that we've both had a great time. So,
completely.
Any other films or franchises or TV series that you're keen to discuss, we'd love to have you on again.
I look forward to doing so.
How do people find you on Twitter?
I'm on Twitter. I mainly tweet about political stuff, I have to say, but I do also talk about stuff in relation to Spider-Man and Doctor Who and other sort of sci-fi and comic book related stuff. You can find me on Twitter at Vortigan, which is Vortigan _.
Is that named after Vortigern from Half-Life, by any chance?
It's Vortigern, which is Old English for High King.
Oh, okay.
It's an Old English word for High King, and Henry means ruler of the home, so I thought there was a nice little synergy there.
Perfect. Sounds good. I'm at Alex C. Halpern, so a bit less imaginative, but that's my name.
I can't remember my...
You're Jack Fryer 22, 23,
something like that. Yeah, just follow the Tom Hanks Defence for Twitter. It's most likely me.
Yeah.
It's most likely me.
We are at Tom Hanks Defence with a C for the Americans. You can find us if you have any questions about this episode, if you have any particular opinions on Into the Spider-Verse, whether that's on topics that we've discussed, or if there is something you have in mind that we weren't able to talk about on this episode, then please tweet us. We'd love to hear your thoughts.
Or message us on Facebook as well.
And we're on Facebook as Tom Hanks Defence.
Or swing, get your web sling and sling into our living rooms and talk to us in person.
We'll keep the windows open.
Yeah.
maybe not after 1 a.m. because we've got to get the beauty sleep in.
Yeah.
So thank you for listening. Thank you, Henry, once again for joining
us.
And we'll be back next time. Yeah, back. back into the Hanksverse re-swing. Thanks, everybody. Take care. Enjoy yourselves.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Tom Hanks Defense Force. Find us and join the conversation on Twitter and Facebook.